This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dexter Filkins, has been doing some excellent reporting from Iraq for the New York Times. In a series of articles last month, he described the street-to-street fighting in Fallujah, where the Marine company he was embedded with rooted out insurgents, getting shot at nearly every step of the way. Filkins has been covering Iraq since the start of the invasion in March 2003. For the past 4 years, he's been a reporter for the New York Times. Prior to that, he was the New Delhi bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He's covered a half dozen armed conflicts in such places as Sri Lanka and Afghanistan. Filkins left Iraq in late November and plans to return after the holidays. I spoke with him yesterday. I wanted you to get a sense of his writing, so I asked him to read an excerpt of his article, datelined Fallujah, November 18th.
The 150 Marines with whom I traveled, Bravo Company of the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, had it as tough as any unit in the fight. They moved through the city almost entirely on foot, into the heart of the resistance, rarely protected by tanks or troop carriers, working their way through Fallujah's narrow streets with 75-pound packs on their backs. In 8 days of fighting, Bravo Company took 36 casualties, including 6 dead, meaning that the unit's men had about a 1 in 4 chance of being wounded or killed in little more than a week. The sound, sights, and feel of the battle were as old as war itself and as new as the Pentagon's latest weapon systems. The eerie pop from the cannon of the AC-130 gunship prowling above the city at night, firing at guerrillas who are often only steps away from Americans on the ground. The weird buzz of the Dragon Eye pilotless airplane hovering over the battlefield as its video cameras beamed real-time images back to the base. The glow of the insurgents' flares throwing daylight over a landscape to help them shoot at their targets. Us. The nervous shove of a Marine scrambling for space along a brick wall as tracer rounds ricocheted above. The silence between the ping of the shell leaving its mortar tube and the explosion when it strikes. The screams of the Marines when one of their comrades, Corporal Jake Nospler, lost part of his jaw to a hand grenade. "No, no, no," the Marines shouted as they dragged Corporal Nospler from the darkened house where the bomb went off. It was 2 a.m., the sky dark without a moon. "No, no, no." Nothing in the combat I saw even remotely resembled the scenes regularly flashed across movie screens. Even so, they often seemed no more real.
Thanks for reading that. That's Dexter Filkins of the New York Times, who's briefly out of Iraq. You know, you write in that November 21st piece that you were just reading for us that nothing in the combat that you saw even remotely resembled the scenes of movies that you'd seen, but even so, they often seem no more real. And what sense did being in the middle of the war sometimes seem no more real than watching movies?
I wonder if a soldier would tell you the same thing. I remember getting out of the troop carrier right as we approached at the outside of the city, and we literally piled out and started walking to the city, and we immediately came under fire from rocket-propelled grenades. And it was dark outside, and the RPGs, as they're known, came sailing over this ridge. And the first thing I thought of was that they're shooting bottle rockets at us, and it's the 4th of July. And that's what they looked like. And they were landing right next to us, and they were exploding, and people were getting hit. And yet I felt like I was in a carnival or something. And it's almost as if you're taken out of your body and you're standing over on the side and watching, and it's just, it doesn't seem real. There was another time when a phosphorus flare exploded all around us, and everything was burning, and it actually burned through my pack and my sleeping bag. And again, I remember thinking, what's all the excitement about? This is just fireworks. And it's strange what your brain does in those odd moments when you should just be utterly terrified. And, you know, instead, again, it seemed like I was a kid at a 4th of July picnic.
You've covered several wars. Was this your first time you covered urban warfare?
It was the first time I covered urban warfare. I have covered several wars. I was there in Afghanistan for the American war there in 2001. I came up with the troops in Iraq in March 2003. I covered some other conflict. It's usually much less intense. People get killed. People get wounded. It can be pretty scary. I've certainly been shot at. But to walk down a crowded city street a dense area like that, where every single window and every street corner, every rooftop is potentially a place from which somebody will be shooting at you, is just a completely different experience. And it's terrifying almost at every moment that you're there. And so we would walk down the street, and I mentioned this in one of my articles, but from the time that we started, which was 8 p.m. at night and it was dark, the combat was continuous, very close range, for the next 16 hours. So until noon the next day, we were being fired at, and they were just popping out everywhere behind us, over on the side, over here, over there, kind of. And so it's just the intensity of it, and you know, your body is just sort of pouring out all this adrenaline, and it's terrifying, but it's also very, very exhausting.
You say we were fired at. Where were you situating yourself during the urban warfare that the Marines were fighting and that you were covering?
I like to say I was getting crouching behind the largest person that I could find, but I was with a company, so it was about, this company was about 150 guys. There was a group of about 10 people. The company commander, who was a captain, Amahundra, who's a quite extraordinary guy. I was with him basically for the most part. He was kind of surrounded by a couple of guys with radios, a couple of sergeants, people like that. And it was a good place to be because we were right in the middle of the fight. But at the same time, just by listening to him and following him around, I could get some sense of the bigger picture. So it wasn't just like I was looking down a straw the whole time. But so we actually, company has three platoons with about, you know, 50 or so people each. And these platoons are often divided up. And during the course of the fighting, Captain Amahundra would often run from one platoon to the other to deliver orders or just to see how things were going. And I would just be sort of scurrying after him to get a sense of it. So I often, it was a good place to be because I often got a pretty good sense of how the whole thing was progressing.
What was the actual specific mission that the Marines you were traveling with were given?
It wasn't like go take the hill, you know, or capture the bridge. We, the Bravo company that I was with, got off in the troop carriers, and their objective was to enter the town at the north end, which was a very defined kind of, you know, cross the street and then the buildings start, and march down to the southern end of the town, which was a couple of miles away, capturing some things along the way, like mosques and, you know, a couple of buildings, an Iraqi National Guard building. But we got to the end of the town on the southern end, you know, 8 days later. And then, I don't know, I remember thinking, well, what do we do now, you know? And there were other companies and other platoons to our left and to our right. And so basically what it amounted to was just an enormous sweep through a city of 250,000 people. Often, the Marines I was with went house to house into every single house on a street, kicking down doors, and we often found people in them who were armed. And so it was a little different than anything I had been in before, but and a little confusing for that reason, but very crazy.
You write, whole buildings, minarets, and human beings were vaporized in the barrages of exploding shells. You saw things being vaporized?
I did. I saw many things being vaporized. Typically, what would happen is the Marines would walk down the street or walk down an alley, say 50 Marines, and it didn't take long. They would come under fire almost immediately, usually. I mean, they would spend the night in a mosque, and they would walk outside, and within 5 minutes, they were under fire. They would fire back. Often they'd fire hundreds and hundreds and thousands of rounds into a building, say, where they thought the insurgents were hiding. But often what they would do after 20 minutes and thousands of rounds of this, they'd call in an airstrike, and the whole building would just disappear. I remember standing on top of a roof of an apartment building one morning, and we were taking fire from kind of down the street. And then over in the corner of my eye, an entire minaret that must have been 150 feet tall just vanished in a cloud of dust. It would be easy, you know, if you think back to World War II or even wars that are more recent, you know, they'd wipe out the whole city block and hope that they hit the building that they wanted. And now they can be a lot more precise.
And yet at the same time, a handful of insurgents hidden in a building could basically trap the American Marines for hours, in spite of all the high-tech weapons.
Absolutely, totally. I mean, that happened to Bravo Company a number of times. And I have to say, it made me wonder when I heard the Pentagon say that they had killed between 800 and 1,200 insurgents. Frankly, I didn't see that many insurgents. I didn't see that many dead insurgents. I know there were a lot of them out there because we were getting shot at a lot. But if you take, there was one day, I think it was the second day that we were in Fallujah, we were held up by what I think was probably a single sniper in a building, in a four-story building across the street. The entire company, 150 guys, was held up for the entire day. And over the course of the day, as this guy would take a shot, and then he'd go to another floor, and he'd take another shot, and then he'd run down the hall, and he'd take another shot, the Marines dropped, they ordered in maybe a dozen bombs, several dozen 155-millimeter artillery shells. They fired thousands and thousands of rounds. They fired rockets into the thing. And so the building was like a smoking ruin. I mean, by 4 p.m., it was just on fire, and it was all black. And still, you know, the bullets would come out. And this was one guy, maybe two guys. And I remember after that long day, some Marines finally made it across the street and searched the building and didn't find anybody. And so that was one insurgent or two, maybe. And he held up. He held up 150 guys for an entire day.
Hmm. You know, and you've been describing some of the high-tech weapons Americans had. One of the things that the Iraqi insurgents were using is a black flag to indicate what?
Well, the black flags in Fallujah were used as a signal, very low-tech, used as a signal to say to other insurgents, come to the fight. We found them. And I have to say, watching a black flag go up was a really creepy thing. You know, it didn't matter that it was primitive as it could be, but it was working. And these flags, we'd see these black flags go up, you know, over a mosque, something high, over a tall building, and then the firing would start. And so it worked really well. But I have to say that the psychological effect of it was almost as intense.
Because you know it's about to start? And you know you're a target?
You know it's about to start. You know it's about to start. There was one particular, it was an early evening, and I was with a platoon. I guess it was about 50 guys. We were walking down a pretty narrow alley. The captain, Captain Almohandro, was in front of me. His radio went off saying, there's a carload of insurgents with RPGs coming in your direction. So everybody kind of got ready. Radio, 2 minutes later, the radio went again saying, there's another truckload of insurgents coming in your direction. Within 5 minutes, we got into a really horrific firefight. But I remember that because we had seen the black flags go up, and then these warnings over the radio, obviously from some spotter, and then it started, and it was very chilling.
And where did you stay during that?
Well, typically, what we did was we would just find a building. The Marines would kick the door down, and we'd all go up on the roof. They were typically flat roofs, and we'd go up on a roof and try to sleep up there. It was a place from which you could see around you, and you could kind of protect yourself pretty well. So we didn't get a lot of sleep during the 8 days or 9 days of the fighting, as you can imagine. The Marines often moved at night, which they liked to do. A lot of them had night vision goggles. The airplanes could be up with their infrared scopes, checking out the battlefield, whereas the insurgents, of course, were more or less blind. There was no electricity in the city. The Americans had shut it off. So we often moved at night, and they felt like that they had the advantage when they were doing that. But I have to say that as a layperson without any kind of night vision goggles or anything like that, it was terrifying to be moving where you can't even see the hand in front of your face. And often the insurgents were, when they figured out that we were coming, they would fire flares over us and light up the whole sky and then start firing. And that's pretty creepy.
My guest is New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins. He's briefly in the States but plans to return to Iraq after the holidays. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins, and he is a reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the war in Iraq since the beginning of the invasion in March of 2003, and he's been in and out several times. He left there most recently in late November and plans to return at the end of the holidays and stay till the end of the election. One of the problems for the Marines that you were traveling with is that there's a lot of deception. So if they saw a civilian or if they saw somebody wearing an Iraqi National Guard uniform, it didn't necessarily mean that they weren't an insurgent. So can you talk a little bit about how that uncertainty affected the performance and the judgment of the Marines?
Well, it made a lot of them very nervous, I should say, and actually pretty frustrated and pretty angry at times. There was an Iraqi unit that was more or less traveling with the Marines, and it was, I don't know, probably 50 guys. And they had kind of very nice uniforms on, brand new, pressed and starched. And the Marines typically would fight their way through a city block, really, really hard fighting, taking casualties, people getting wounded, people getting killed, to the doorstep of a mosque. And then they would more or less swing the door open, and they'd call in this Iraqi unit that would then come in their brand new clean uniforms. They would then come in and take, quote unquote, take the mosque. That's pretty much what they were used for. They really weren't used for much more than that. And so it was kind of, I wouldn't say it was a joke, but it was they weren't doing a lot of fighting, the Iraqis. But as a result, the American Marines couldn't, if they saw an Iraqi in a military uniform, say, or an Iraqi with a gun, they couldn't just open fire as they would be inclined to do in a situation like that. They had to check out whether, you know, this person was a friendly Iraqi soldier. And so that caused moments of great confusion. And there was one particular moment, and it was nighttime. It was very dark. I was with a platoon of Marines, about 50 guys. We were walking down a street, turned a corner, and there was a group of Iraqi soldiers. Well, what appeared to be Iraqi soldiers, they were a group of Iraqi guys with Iraqi military uniforms on. And the Americans in the Iraqi military, the official Iraqi military, had agreed on certain things to allay the nervousness of the Americans, like you should wear red tape on your arm and you should wear a piece of white tape on your leg. They even had the red tape and the white tape. So the Americans saw, the Marines that I was with saw these Iraqis and said, hey, no problem, and they waved to them. That only took a moment, but the Iraqis opened fire. They killed one of the Americans that I was with. Another guy probably lost his leg. I still remember him screaming on the ground. And the Iraqis took off. And that was the kind of confusion that was being sown at the time. And I remember the next day talking to one of the Marines about it, and he said, you know, just because we got to have these silly Iraqis out here to enter these mosques, it's causing my men to hesitate, and that hesitation is leading to their deaths.
So there's no one answer to this, but what do you do when you think somebody might be about to shoot you, but you're not really sure, and you're not sure if they're friend or foe? I mean, if you do the wrong thing, you've killed an innocent person, and if you don't shoot a person who's about to shoot you, you're dead.
Well, exactly. I mean, that was the essence of what the Marines were going through just about every moment mm-hmm. of every day out there. And there were a couple of moments when that came into play pretty dramatically. There was the moment I just described where they hesitated and they died. And I should just back up a second and say what was strange about this battle was that it was an urban fight, and it's a very dense urban area where the buildings are very close together and the streets are very narrow. But there really weren't a lot of people in the city. There really weren't a lot of civilians. Most of the, I would say almost all of the civilians, 250,000 people, had cleared out of the city before the fighting began. In that sense, when the Marines would shoot into a building or they'd call in an airstrike, the chances were pretty good that they weren't going to kill a lot of civilians. But that same uncertainty often left or often led to pretty tragic moments. There was a time, I think it was about the third day that we were there. There was a lot of fighting going on. And for whatever reason, a family of Iraqis, I think it was about five people, a man and a wife and their children, had been hiding in a building where the fighting was going on. And they decided that that was the moment that they should run into their car and jump in the car and try to get away. And they did that. And, of course, they drove right into a line of Marines. And the Marines didn't know who they were or what was going on. And there was a lot of yelling. They opened fire. One of the women was killed. A couple others were wounded. It was a very sad scene. And, of course, the Marines didn't mean to do it. And it's really difficult to blame them for what they did. But that was the kind of confusion that we saw. And it was just inherent in the environment that we were in, where everything was so close together. And it was so difficult to tell friend from foe.
Dexter Filkins is a New York Times reporter. He's briefly in the States, but plans to return to Iraq after the holidays. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins. He's been reporting from Iraq since March of 2003, when the invasion began. Last month, he was embedded with a company of Marines in Fallujah, traveling with them during the street-to-street and house-to-house fighting. Filkins is briefly in the U.S. and plans to return to Iraq after the holidays.
Can you talk about how mosques were used during the fighting in Fallujah by the insurgents and by the Marines, and if a lot of the mosques were destroyed in the fighting?
Well, you know, ideally, places of worship would not be used in a battle like this. But I have to say, I think that the Marines I was with, Bravo Company, we were fired on from virtually every mosque that we passed. And usually from the minarets, the big towers, the kind of spiraling towers, were almost invariably used by Iraqi snipers. I remember the first, it was very creepy, the first night that we came in, it was pitch black and it was about 8 o'clock at night, and nobody really knew what to expect. We were getting fired on almost instantly, but we were just really at the edge of town, and I could hear the echoes from all the mosques saying, "Allah Akbar, God is great, prepare for jihad." And you could hear this echoing throughout the entire city. And I had this image of, oh my God, you know, there's going to be hundreds and hundreds of people coming to greet us. But so they were. The mosques were used in every way. I mean, the Marines I was with searched mosques and found weapon stores and bomb factories and everything else. And I was with some guys who were killed right next to me, with a guy who was killed right next to me in the minaret of a mosque, shot right in the head. And so I remember, I think it was the first day that I was there, when it became apparent that these mosques were being used, the captain that I was with had to get very He had to put in a very explicit request to take out the mosque, and that request had to go all the way up, you know, the military chain of command. And it finally came back several minutes later, and they said, "Okay, we're going to take out the mosque." And by, I think it was 24 hours later, after the company I was with had taken so much fire from so many different mosques, that the gloves came off, as it were, and they no longer needed the approval from, you know, way high up the food chain. It was, if you take fire from a mosque, take out the mosque. And so as a result of that, the Marines I was with were taking fire from every mosque that we passed. And so many mosques were destroyed as a result of that.
You mentioned the captain who you were traveling with, Captain Omohundro. And you write about him time and time again through the week. He kept his men from folding, if not by his resolute manner, then by his calmness under fire. Can you talk about how that calmness was manifested during the 8 days of fighting, and what kind of, you know, what his style of leadership was?
I should just start by saying that one of the things that struck me as a civilian and somebody who doesn't know very much about the military is just how young everybody is. I mean, it was just, most of the soldiers are 19 or 20 years old. You know, they're just, I mean, they're really just kids. You know, some of them, their voices have barely changed. And Captain Reed Omohundro was 34. He was extraordinary. I mean, he had 150 guys under his command. He's responsible for all their lives. I remember the first night we got out of the troop carriers and we're taking fire from every direction. It was pitch black. There was a unit that was supposed to be, that we were supposed to link up with. Nobody knew where they were. They apparently went off in some other direction. Basically, the whole unit was terrified. I don't think anybody had ever seen anything like this. Everybody was on the ground. I was on the ground. The explosions were going off everywhere. They were firing rocket-propelled grenades at us. And I looked up, and there was Captain Omohundro standing there, really as if he were ready to tee off, on a golf ball. I mean, he was completely calm. He was talking into his radio. And as terrified, I was completely terrified, and I kind of looked up and I thought, well, you know, it was very reassuring that here's a guy, he knows what's going on here, and, you know, he has some idea of where we're supposed to be and where we're going, because, my God, nobody else does. And that happened over and over again, where scenes of extraordinary chaos, where the shooting is so loud you can't even hear, and you don't know where the bullets are coming from, and you're under attack from three different directions. And everybody, I mean, again, these are 19-year-old kids, and they're incredibly impressive, and they're very well disciplined, but it's terrifying. And the guys who were typically in charge, the platoon commanders who were usually, I think they were all about 23 or 24, and Captain Omohundro was 34, never flinched. And the result of that was the unit never flinched. And it was an extraordinary thing to witness.
You write about one of the sergeants, Sergeant Wells, who was killed in Fallujah. And it sounds from your writing that the men really admired him a lot. How was he killed?
He was killed on the first morning of the battle. It was about 7 a.m. The fighting had been going on at that point for 11 hours. We had been under fire. The sun was up. The first objective of the unit was to take a mosque that was, my gosh, it was only about 200 yards into the city, but that's how long it had taken us just to move that far. We came under fire, extraordinary fire, from two directions. As soon as we got close to the mosque, the insurgents opened up, and then the Marines opened up, and it was this incredible gun battle that it just went on and on and on. Couldn't hear, couldn't see. Right in the middle of this, one of the lieutenants, or Captain Omohundro, gave the order to take the mosque. And one of the platoons, of which Sergeant Wells was a member, I think it was the second platoon, ran across the street, into the street, and up the street towards the mosque. They ran right into interlocking machine gun fire. And I think 40 guys ran across that road. And by the time that platoon got to the other side of the road, there were five Marines lying in the road. One of them was Sergeant Wells. He bled to death in the middle of the road. The amazing thing, and this happened time again almost every day, was Marines would go down wounded, shot, or dead in just really a storm of gunfire, and other Marines would turn and run into the fire to get their buddies out, and it just didn't matter what was being thrown at them. And that's what happened in this case. There were five Marines lying in the road, all of them shot, bleeding. Sergeant Wells was still alive. He'd been hit in the leg. He was bleeding profusely, and one guy after another ran into the road to pull him out. They didn't get Sergeant Wells out in time, and he bled to death shortly afterwards. The other four that got out, he was a senior. Sergeant Wells was a kind of senior guy in the platoon, which I think meant that he was about 27 or something. But he had kind of taken a bunch of the younger guys under his wing, and he'd written letters to their parents saying, "Look, we're going to go into battle, and I'm going to look after these guys, and they're all good kids, and you don't have anything to worry about." And so everybody was really close to him, and were pretty shaken when he died.
Did you have conversations with the Marines that you traveled with about death and their fears of death? If they allowed themselves to think about that?
That's a very good question. In the barracks before the big fight started, it was I was with one platoon. It was about 50 guys. We were all, you know, sleeping on these cots, and again, they're all 19 and 20 years old, and it felt like a high school football team before the big game, and everybody, they were definitely nervous, but they didn't sit around and talk about death and what if I die and, oh my God, I'm so terrified. It was more kind of a lot of joking and kind of towel popping than anything. But, and the strange thing was they were definitely nervous. I mean, you could tell, but we went into battle and a lot of Marines were wounded and killed, and they continued. I should say, I think in the first week, that unit, Bravo Company, took 36 casualties out of 150 guys, and I left. And after I left, they continued to take casualties, and, you know, they're still there. But the really unusual thing was that they didn't talk about it very much, almost at all, when one of their comrades went down. And unless under, you know, great prodding from somebody like me when the fighting was over. And I tried to talk to him about that. I mean, I noticed immediately then when one of their buddies and, you know, obviously a good friend was killed or wounded and taken away, why wasn't everybody standing around sobbing about it? And you know, the answer, and I guess it's an obvious answer, was that, you know, that's a luxury that we can't afford right now. And typically the answer was, I'll deal with it when I get home. And there's a time for mourning, but that time is not right now, because if we all sit around here and start sobbing about our dead friends, then we're not going to be able to get anything done. It's a very good answer, and it's probably the only answer, but it's an odd thing to witness, and you can tell. I mean, you can just imagine the strain that they're all under and what they're holding back, and what inevitably is going to come out when they get home.
My guest is New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins. He's briefly in the States and plans to return to Iraq after the holidays. Last month, he was embedded with a company of Marines in Fallujah. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins, and he writes for the New York Times. He's been covering Iraq, going in and out since the beginning of the invasion in March of 2003. We're talking now about the Battle of Fallujah, which he covered for the Times, and he was embedded with the Marines. One of the big controversies in the United States now is, should Donald Rumsfeld, you know, resign or be forced out, or should he continue as Secretary of Defense? And I'm wondering if any of the Marines that you traveled with in Fallujah, or any of the soldiers that you met before that, had any questions about how the war was being run, or whether the war, you know, how the strategy, the armor or lack of armor, you know, all the questions that we're hearing about in the States, were the troops raising any of those questions?
Well, I should make a distinction, because you do hear, usually privately, and on occasion, I shouldn't say it's either prevalent or very often, but among the senior officers in the American military, guys who are, you know, paid and responsible for thinking about big questions and about how the war is progressing or not progressing, they do ask those questions, and they have expressed frustration. I mean, I've certainly heard some of that. You know, should we ever have come here to begin with? It's usually a little bit more poignant than that. I remember talking to a lieutenant colonel who said, I'm tired of having to write these letters home to their mothers saying that, you know, your son's been killed and he was a good guy. I'm tired of that. You do hear that from the senior guys. At the sort of grunt level, you don't hear as much of it. I think it's more of a much more kind of visceral frustration. The conditions there are so difficult. I mean, I can't. It's hard for me to describe them, but I remember I was with the same Marines in the summertime. I went out there to Fallujah and spent some time with them, and it's 125 degrees during the day, and, you know, they go out on a patrol, and every time the Marines leave the gates of their base, their lives are in danger, and you know, usually on any given day, one of them doesn't come back alive, and so that inevitably has a great effect on morale. I mean, I should say that I think, by and large, the morale of the Marines and in Fallujah and the morale of the military at that level among the grunts is pretty high. I mean, they feel pretty good about what they're doing, and they think they're doing the right thing. But occasionally you do see some of that frustration.
I think the pieces that you wrote about the Battle of Fallujah are really quite extraordinary. I was wondering if you read them to the Marines, before or after they were published.
That's a good question. No, I haven't. In fact, I just got done sort of gathering them all and sending them by email. But the conditions were usually too insane to do anything like that. I mean, most of these things I was, you know, either I would turn on my laptop and go inside of my sleeping bag at night so the light didn't come out and kind of try to put something together, or I would get on the phone, a satellite phone, on the top of a building, you know, usually at, you know, midnight or something, and try to dictate some things. But one of the things that did happen, which was kind of neat, was I started getting emails, 2 days into the battle, I started getting emails, which I would download over my satellite telephone onto my laptop from the parents of and from the family members of guys in the unit. So I remember I got one from the mother of a corporal saying, you know, oh my gosh, my son's in that unit. Could you please say hi to him for me? And I love him so much. And oh my gosh, if anything ever happened to him, I wouldn't be able to bear it. And so and since then, I've gotten a lot of. It does look like to me that most of the families of, if not the soldiers, have seen what I've written, and so I've actually been contacted by a lot of those families, and particularly by families whose sons were killed or wounded. Very sad letters. Often asking, saying, "I know you were there, and could you just tell me anything about my son and what his last moments were like, and did he suffer, and that sort of thing." So that part of it is particularly crushing.
I want to quote something you wrote in October of this year. And this was a piece that was about what it's like to be a reporter in Iraq. And this was, of course, before the Battle of Fallujah. And you write, "At the New York Times, we have spared no expense to protect ourselves. The catalog of near misses is long enough to chill the hardiest war correspondent. We have been shot at, kidnapped, blindfolded, held at knife point, held at gunpoint, detained, threatened, beaten, and chased." What's the worst that's happened to you?
Well, I should say that in the Battle of Fallujah, we had a number of close calls. I've gone through my nine lives already, I think, as we all have over there. I think the closest one that we had was in Fallujah. I was with a photographer, Ashley Gilbertson, and we were in this was about, I think, the eighth day of the fighting, and there was a mosque where apparently the Marines had taken a lot of fire from this mosque, and in particular from a minaret that was probably 75 feet high. And the Marines had fired a tank shell at it and then killed a guy up at the top. So we were going into the minaret to check out this dead insurgent, and Ashley and I, the photographer. And as we were entering the minaret, a couple of Marines said, "Nope, we're going to check it out. That's why we're here." And went up to the top of the minaret in front of us. The Marine who was in the front, Corporal Billy Miller, was shot in the face as he got to the top. He was killed, I think, instantly, and came tumbling back down the stairs, basically right on top of us. But and that was a horrific scene, because he was on the stairs about three quarters of the way up. There was an insurgent with a gun up at the top, who was obviously willing to die, and the Marines, in the extraordinary way that they do these things, were determined to get Corporal Miller out of there, and so then proceeded to go into the minaret and go up its winding staircase to get him out, even as this guy was shooting down on them. And then as that was happening, the unit came under attack from all around the mosque, and so they finally got Corporal Miller out of there, and then we all had to take off running to get away from these guys who were attacking. So it was that's as close probably as I came in Fallujah, but that was a particularly tough moment.
My guest is New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins. He's been reporting from Iraq since the start of the invasion in March of 2003. Last month, he was embedded with a company of Marines in Fallujah. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He's been in and out of Iraq several times since the beginning of the invasion in March of 03, you were embedded with the Marines in Fallujah, and you're traveling with them. You get to know them. All your lives are on the line. And so, of course, in some ways it would go without saying that you're identifying with the Marines in a way that you wouldn't necessarily identify with another story that you were writing. How do you think that affects the coverage, and is that a problem if you identify with them too much, or does it just make for really good empathic journalism?
Well, it might be a problem. I'm not sure that it was in this case. I mean, I should say that I've seen a lot of carnage in Iraq, and I've seen a lot of dead people, and I've seen people die, and I've seen a lot of bodies and body parts and all of that. But usually, I don't know who these people are, you know, and whether they're American or whether they're Iraqi. And to hang out with a bunch of guys, you know, for a couple of weeks and to get to know them really well and to go through that sort of thing together and then to see them be killed is altogether a different experience. And you know, I found myself being quite broken up when some of these guys were killed, because I had gotten to know them pretty well and they were, you know, they're real people and they have families back home and people who care about them. As far as whether it affects the coverage that we're doing, that's for my readers to judge, I think. But I was conscious of that, and I did everything I could to avoid whatever it was that I would, you know, whether it would be cheerleading or getting a little bit too swept up in the moment. I think the larger problem is just in the when you're embedded and when you're walking and traveling with a particular an American military unit, is making sure that you get the other side of the story, the Iraqi side of the story, and that's very difficult, and one that I would concede is a problem.
You're going back to Iraq after the holidays, and you expect to stay until the election. When you think about the election happening in about, 6 weeks?
End of January, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think the country will be ready for an election that Iraqis and the rest of the world will be able to think of as fair and representative?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, the election, it seems, by all accounts, is going to happen on January 30th. And it also seems inevitable that there's going to be an extraordinary amount of violence leading up to that. And that violence is being generated by people who want to wreck the election. And so the result is, and you can see what happened just yesterday in Iraq, you had simultaneous car bombs near a couple of holy sites in southern Iraq that killed more than 60 people. You had three election workers, Iraqi election workers, dragged out of their cars and shot and killed, shot in the head, right in the middle of rush hour traffic in the morning. And so I think a lot of Iraqis are going to vote. And I think a lot of Iraqis understand exactly what democracy is, and they want it to happen. I mean, and I think amid all of the chaos and shooting and horrific violence that we see, the one glimmer of hope, I think, and it's just a glimmer, but is that you've got the Shiite population in Iraq. It's probably about 60% of the country. You've got the Kurds. They're about maybe 20%. That's 80% of the population that really wants to have an election and really wants to vote and probably will vote. And so what the picture that you have really is kind of that versus the Arab Sunni minority, maybe 20-25% of the population that probably will sit it out in great numbers. That's the community that's generating the most violence. So I think the question is going to be after the election is what do you do with this very unhappy, disenfranchised, deeply, deeply disaffected minority?
Many American soldiers are getting sent back for another tour of duty. You're going back to Iraq voluntarily to continue your coverage for the New York Times. You've had a lot of close calls. It's been pretty harrowing. What gets you to go back?
That's a good question. Well, I don't know, frankly. I mean, the soldiers who are going back, I don't I don't know how they do it. You know, as tough as it is to work there as a journalist, it's nowhere near as difficult as it is to be a soldier. I mean, you know, I can leave, you know, every couple of months I get to leave and come back. And we have a pretty nice house there, and it's not so bad. And these guys are eating, you know, this terrible food. And they're getting shot at and killed virtually every day. So it's kind of a different – it's a different thing. I mean, as a journalist, it's just, you know, this is an epic, extraordinary enterprise that probably won't be surpassed, you know, in our lifetimes. It's something that is quite – it's quite incredible to witness and to cover and to be present as history is made and as this grand enterprise unfolds. And so I guess in a way it's addictive.
Well, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I wish you good luck and safety, and I think your writing is great. Thank you very, very much for talking with
us. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dexter Filkins is a New York Times reporter. He's briefly in the States and plans to return to Iraq after the holidays.